Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute, Edelman's global research center for the study and cultivation of trust. Welcome to a special series of the show where we will be recording on the ground from Davos at the 2023 annual meeting of the World Economic Forum. Throughout the week, I will be speaking with attendees who are experts in their fields about this year's forum and gather their insights on our just released 2023 Edelman Trust Barometer. For our third and final installment of our 2023 Davos series, I'm joined by Professor Heidi Larson. Heidi, an anthropologist, is the director and founder of the Vaccine Confidence Project. She is also a professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and author of Stuck, How Vaccine Rumors Start and Why They Don't Go Away. Parenthetically, I sent that book to about 30 friends and colleagues during COVID. Heidi is one of the world's leading experts on vaccine hesitancy and has spent decades studying the social and political factors that can affect health interventions and influence policies. Heidi, welcome to the Trustmakers.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Heidi, tell us about the Vaccine Confidence Project. When and why did you start it?
Well, I founded the Vaccine Confidence Project in 2010, but I was inspired to start it between 2000 and 2005. I was leading UNICEF's strategy and communication for introducing new vaccines around the world and was chairing the advocacy work for Gavi and the launch of Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization. And it was a fascinating time. I, to be honest, didn't expect vaccines to be as interesting as they became. I had worked a lot in AIDS, which was a very dynamic and lively, passionate kind of communication landscape. And for vaccines, I didn't expect what I was coming into, to be honest. I thought it was going to be a much more straightforward type of communication. And boy, I came at a real turning point, I think, in terms of public trust and willingness and the beginnings of, I mean, there are historic episodes, of course, of vaccine protests from back to the 1800s. But I started to see this newer trend of a much more generalized, not necessarily protest-driven questioning around vaccines.
And was that from like right when you took over this role? Is it something that's grown? Talk about the evolution of that.
Well, it wasn't in the first year. I was just getting a read on the landscape and doing a lot of field visits, and we were starting to introduce some vaccines. So I would say it was more getting into the second and third years where I started to get to know the players, the government partners, as well as you know, other partners on the ground, our field offices around the world. They started to know my role also, and I started to get more and more calls to come and help because they didn't know how to deal with these different types of refusals.
And are these talk about how those refusals manifested themselves then and maybe how they then grew into what most of our, all of our listeners are very aware of?
Well, it was different in different countries. Sometimes it was a very outspoken parent who was absolutely convinced, like in Sarajevo, that, you know, their child was damaged by a vaccine and happened to be highly networked in media and with government colleagues and got huge coverage. And we only discovered what the source of this was is when we saw all of a sudden vaccine acceptance starting to plummet, and then started to hear from the local office, well, this was what was going on. And in other countries too, it was different things. Sometimes it was around polio vaccination. There was you know, anxiety in some of the marginalized communities about why do you keep coming back with the same vaccine and not others, you know, were suspicious. And in some places, it was government officials or even scientists who are saying, whoa, you know, why are you pushing these new, more expensive vaccines? We can't even, you know, catch up with the basic ones. And, you know, what's the motive? Somebody's making money here.
It was
a mix of different.
Yeah, it almost seems like central to this is a total misunderstanding of how science works. The idea that science is, there is the scientific method of trial and error and test and improve. It feels like there's just some fundamental misunderstanding here or lack of understanding.
Well, actually, I wish it had been that, because that's much more straightforward to fix in a sense. Well, maybe not so straightforward, but this was often about trust issues. It was about distrust of government, distrust of the motive. This must be about money making. This is government trying to control us. People genuinely thinking there's a problem with a particular vaccine that because it didn't make sense to them. And it was a different mix of things. Issues also around, for instance, HPV vaccine and adolescent girls. Some of that became much more of a, you know, well, our young girls are not having sex. We don't need this vaccine. And, you know, we would say it's more about cancer prevention. But so sometimes it was religious issues. Sometimes it was ideological. And those are the kinds of things you can't fix with facts.
Yeah. And you learned so much about how to combat vaccine hesitancy through a number of these vaccines that some of which you've mentioned just now. Bring us to 2020 and COVID, preparing for vaccine rollout. What had you learned that perhaps made you anxious about the vaccine rollout? And then I'd love to start going into kind of some of the solutions as well for building confidence.
One of the reasons that I left UNICEF to set up this vaccine confidence project was I realized that a lot of people would come to me and say, I need X amount of posters or a video or this or that for this new vaccine campaign, or because they're not taking it in this place. One of the things I learned is we're not listening enough to what's really going on. We're not tailoring our engagement and communications in a way that is relevant to people's lives. And the other big question I got a lot was, well, how big is this a problem? It's just fringe. It's just a bunch of crazies. And so we developed the metric to measure it. So in this time period, we have been measuring, monitoring, investigating, built a global network of research to investigate it. So when it came to COVID, we kind of had a map of the world in terms of where critical issues were, who had the most stable vaccine programs, who had the most wobbly ones, you know, where were the weak spots in the system? Because after a decade of, you know, mapping and investigating these things, you start to get a feel for where the issues are. So there are certain areas where I anticipated that, and we as a research group anticipated where we might need a bit more investment, but COVID was different. And because it wasn't just about childhood vaccine or a specific adolescent, it was everybody. The other thing that came up, 2010 was only a couple of years after some of the social media platforms opened their doors. I mean, Facebook, I think 2006 or 2008 started to, and then Twitter and the others. So what has happened, the big change too, in the meanwhile, is just the scale and impact of all this. And it's become a very different landscape, much more politicized. And in COVID, because it was for everyone, it's been used for other grievances besides vaccines.
What are some of the ways, though, that you saw successfully combating vaccine hesitancy? And was there ways that the data and research that you had done helped inform that or helped lead to your interventions?
Absolutely. And I think if there was the number one thing that helped the most was listen to what's really going on. Don't assume that you know why they're hesitating unless you ask them, unless you sit and understand. Because sometimes, actually, it was a pretty basic issue. We learned in one situation, we thought it was rumors, but actually the community said, we don't want, if this was for a polio campaign, we don't want men coming from a faraway city to come vaccinate and go away. We want local women, and we, you know, that if something happens, we know where to find them. They can help us. We know what to do. So, and that was pretty straightforward. In other cases, it's more, it's not as straightforward, but you start to understand why a community is not trusting the government, because they feel marginalized, because they feel like you never bring us anything else and you keep coming with this new thing. So by understanding what the issues were and what was driving their hesitancy, you can tailor the engagement better.
And how do you listen at scale, though, right? Like, these are, like, are you listening to actual individuals? Is there a way you're monitoring conversations? Like, how do you actually listen at scale, and then how do you intervene at scale?
Well, a combination of things. You're absolutely right. We can't do the deep dives and focus groups and everywhere in the world. And that's why we developed the Vaccine Confidence Index, which is run at scale, nationally representative, globally. And we keep our finger on the pulse. And when we see drops in vaccine acceptance, then we do more deep dives. And to the extent that our partnering ministries or collaborators in country are interested in that. And then sometimes specific crises come up and people ask for us to come in and help them get a handle on what's driving all this.
Yeah. Through the work that Vaccine Confidence Project is doing with the Edelman Trust Institute, I'm aware that you're taking the Vaccine Confidence Project in some really interesting new directions. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I never expected to be spending this many years on vaccine research, but we've really seen that vaccines are such a window on a lot of other issues. It's an incredible window on trust relations, trust in government, trust in the health system, trust in the producers of vaccines, trust or distrust. And we've seen in COVID that some of the same reasons people were hesitant about vaccines or didn't take them, the same people were, you know, there were other interventions they were resistant about. So it's really been a bigger window, but I've become much more focused. We're still continuing our work with vaccines, but my current real concern is the disinformation environment right now, and the level of extremism that we've been doing social media monitoring alongside the surveys. And something happened in COVID that just the vaccine conversations went everywhere. And I think a lot of people who had no clue what was going on, you know, in the conversations, because they weren't looking for information on vaccine. There's a whole cohort of people that aren't parents with kids, that aren't adolescent girls looking online for HPV, or an adult looking at flu or shingles vaccine or whatever. And all those other people started going online looking for vaccine information during COVID, and were confronted with a whole mass of good, bad, and really bad information. So we've got a lot of work to do.
We definitely do. And disinformation has been a theme with all three guests this week. You and I, actually, just earlier today, co-hosted a roundtable around building a more trusted health ecosystem. There's a closed-door conversation, so let's not use names, but any key takeaways from that conversation?
Well, one, it was a fascinating conversation, and I really interesting mix of media, government, private sector, and research. One thing that struck me was one comment that in the social media environment, the dynamic is organize, control, distort. That really struck me as, and particularly the organized part, because we often think about the mis and disinformation. We don't always pay attention to the organizing power of social media and how remote communities and networks can rapidly self-organize. So it's not just about that sentiment, it's about how it can be organized with purposeful disruption, and not disruption in the positive sense, but really in the very classic sense of damaging disruption.
Well, it's interesting. One of the participants today talked about how so much of the disinformation can be traced back to a few actors, but then to your point, it explodes through this ecosystem and organization. Is one of the solves here to kind of borrow the same playbook and fight back the same way?
Well, I don't think fighting back would be productive right now, because even since my book came out in 2020, there has been an absolute hardening of people's views in ways that we really didn't see certainly 10 years ago, and I think even five. There was this larger movable middle, as some people call it, and to, you know, the very pro-vaccine, of course we take the vaccine, and kind of a more extreme, we're not going to take it for whatever reason. But that's that middle movable undecided middle has shrunk to a polarization that is reflective of the broader societal polarization. And to me, that is the number one issue and challenge of our time.
Yeah, and our report that we put out this week is focused on polarization and restoring the social fabric. I almost, though, I'm hearing from you that there's almost like a hopelessness about a certain group of people who are just going to believe what they believe. And it's more about influencing people in the middle or mobilizing people on the other side. Talk a little bit about how you navigate this polarized environment.
Well, I don't think we can. I always have some grain of hope. but I don't think we need to start to facilitate dialogue. I don't think turning our back to the extreme anti-groups is the solution. We've done that for too long, and that's what's given them a red carpet to fill the space. And we didn't ever believe that they would be capable of taking, you know, the extent of their influence. But I don't think the way to engage them is around the topics that they're most against. I think we need to find other areas that we can connect on, and it has to happen in other ways. And we're going to have to, you know, people talk about getting out of the box. One of my absolute favorite children's books is The Little Prince. And in the beginning of The Little Prince, where he's drawing, someone asks him to draw a sheep. And he tries to draw the sheep, and they say that doesn't really look like a sheep. And he tries again, and then they say that's really not like a sheep. And then what he does is he draws a box, and the adult says, "Well, where's the sheep?" And he said, "It's in the box. Use your imagination." It was brilliant, and I think actually we should look. We have to be like that. And the box is our challenge. And we need to use our imagination to think about, well, how are we going to go about this? Let's not think of the old ways of doing this, because that's not an option anymore. We have to really look at what is our current state of affairs? Where can we find some level of synergy and work on that.
So it's very much not just about combating vaccine hesitancy by focusing just on vaccines. You need to get right to the foundation and start developing a trusted relationship where someone's going to begin to listen to you in the first place.
And that's where I'm not dropping the ball on vaccines, but that principle is so relevant to climate science. It's relevant to the anti-democracy. There's a whole field that if we can crack this one, it will have a knock-on effect in a lot of different ways. So the other piece of it is we need to start young, because there is, you know, these are the hardened ones are the old adults. But the worrying thing is we've seen a drop in confidence in vaccines, a higher drop in confidence in the younger age cohort than the older, like the 18 to 35. That's a worrying, because these are the future parents. And we need to work with school kids, get more critical thinking, get more collaborative ways to overcome differences when they're young. But also, we really need to figure out ways that, particularly coming out of COVID, people have a lot of challenges with mental health, with others, and if we can do positive things that are their felt needs and not try to tell them they've got the wrong idea about X, but say, what are your felt needs and what can we do about it?
Yeah, well, making this even more challenging is this concept that people don't engage with people who they disagree with. So one of the most shocking findings in our study is less than 30% of people would be willing to live near, work next to, or help if they were in need, someone that they strongly disagree with on important societal issues. So with that backdrop, where does the hope here come?
Well, for me, that was the most poignant, worrying data in the whole report, because that is way beyond any vaccine or whatever. If you're not willing to help someone who, you know, fell and might have broken a leg or whatever, because you don't agree with them, or don't even want to live in the same neighborhood, that's deep, and that's what we need to be working on.
So let's turn to Davos and the meeting this week. You've been coming off and on for more than two decades. What are some of your takeaways so far this week?
Well, it's nice to see it lively again. I know that there was the couple years of COVID gap, and then there was a smaller one in May, but back in full swing. But there are a lot of, one thing about Davos is that it really talks about the critical issues of the time. I think the whole theme of cooperation in a fragmented world is exactly what we're talking about, the need for cooperation in a fragmented, and it's more than fragmented, it's aggressively polarized in places. Energy, the energy crisis, Ukraine, food security, climate. I mean, it's all happening here. If we can leave here with some new ideas or, you know, more investment in old ideas that can work, it's good. But I think one thing that relevant to the Edelman report is that business is top of the deck in who people are turning to for where getting us out of this mess. And you know, there's no more powerful forum of business and leaders than here. And it's not only business leaders here. We've got heads of state. We've got, you know, academics like myself. We have NGO. I mean, there are a mix of people here. But the world is looking to businesses to, you know, weigh in, and because they have the trust of their employee base and communities.
a lot of our listeners are business people. If you were to ask for their help, ask our listeners for their help, what is one thing that they could do to help combat misinformation, to help vaccine confidence? What is one piece of advice that you would give them or something you would really ask them to do?
Well, I would start with my employee base, because I think the trust building with your employee base is going to be crucial. And they all go home to communities, to families, to their, you know, if they're religious, to their churches or mosques or temples, you know, there or whatever community groups and things they're involved with, professional societies. So I think that's an important place to start. The communities they're based in around the world. I mean, there's, you know, a lot of the companies here are in multiple global settings, and really look at ways that they can engage and infuse some positive positive, well, hope for one thing, but provide forums for people to maybe talk about things in different ways.
Yeah, I think a lot of our research has shown that the workplace is an island of civility and a place where people can have some of these tougher conversations. So I think that really can be a role for business.
Yeah, I would welcome that.
Terrific. Well, Heidi, that's all we have time for. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I hope you enjoy your last day and a half here in Davos.
Thanks so much.
And to our listeners, thank you for listening to The Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.